This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Describing himself as a Christian moderate, my guest John Danforth, a former three-term Republican senator from Missouri and an ordained Episcopal priest, has criticized his party for becoming the political arm of conservative Christians. His criticisms were made in two op-ed pieces published in the New York Times. In late March, he criticized his party for its fixation on a religious agenda. His op-ed from June 17th discussed how moderate Christians reject the notion that religion should present a series of wedge issues to energize a political base. He wrote, "We believe it is God's work to reach out to those with whom we disagree and to overcome the meanness we see in today's politics." We invited Senator Danforth to discuss his concerns. He was first elected to the Senate in 1976 and served for 18 years. In 2001, President Bush appointed him Special Envoy for Peace to Sudan. He was appointed UN Ambassador by the President last July. He resigned from the position after less than 7 months. He's now a partner with the law firm Bryan Cave and is based in their St. Louis office. In your March 30th New York Times op-ed piece, you said, "By a series of recent initiatives, Republicans have transformed our party into the political arm of conservative Christians." In what way do you think the party has become the political arm of conservative Christians?
This is a recent development. It's just occurred, I think, in the last 2, 3, 4 years. But increasingly, the Republican Party has become a religious party, taking upon itself the agenda of Christian conservatives. And the agenda items include such matters as the Terry Schiavo case, which prompted that op-ed piece that I wrote, and then the opposition to stem cell research, which I think can only be justified by as a religious position, and then other matters as well. The proposed constitutional amendment on gay marriage, I think, is part of it. So I think what's happened is that it's not just isolated issues that people can agree on or disagree on, but it's the studied way in which the Republican Party has become the party of the religious right.
Now, you're saying that as a retired Episcopal priest. So how does being a priest yourself enter into your analysis and your concern about the party?
I am a Republican and always have been. I am a practicing Christian and have been since I was an infant. I am ordained into the priesthood of the Episcopal Church. This is all part of what I am. But there is a big distinction between church and state, between religion and politics, especially in this country. We've seen what happens in other countries when politics and religion get mixed up and when the state does become an instrument of religion. It has very bad results, very divisive, sometimes violent results. We have steered away from that in the United States, and it's important to continue to steer away from it. That doesn't mean that religious people should not be involved in politics. I think they should be. They're going to insist that they be involved in politics and that they do their best to put across their own positions on the issues. But the problem is when there is a direct connection between government and religion or between a political party and religion.
What do you think are the greatest dangers now to your party? Because you think the party has become the party of conservative Christians, and what kind of dangers do you think that that poses for the larger political climate in our country?
I think some people would say this is great for the Republican Party, that they benefit it, that people who have not traditionally been Republicans are voting the Republican ticket. But in a larger sense for the country, it's not a good thing, because the importance of our political system right from the beginning is to try to hold together a very diverse nation as one nation. That was the purpose of our Constitution. That's our system of government.
During your 3 terms as a senator from Missouri, did being an Episcopal priest was that ever in conflict with how you saw your role or your vote as a senator?
I don't think being an Episcopal priest was the issue. It's more a question of being a practicing Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that I brought to the Senate the totality of who I am as a person. I am a lawyer. I am a husband. I am a father. I am a practicing Christian. All of that goes into my makeup. But there is a big difference between your faith affecting who you are and being a part of who you are on one hand, and on the other hand, viewing yourself as the political instrument of a particular religious point of view. And I definitely did not do that. Now, were some of the interests that I had in the Senate influenced by my religion? Yes, they were. But did I do anything, to the best of my knowledge, to try to advance a particular sectarian cause when I was in the Senate? No, I didn't. I thought that that would have been very improper.
Now, you are a Christian and a Republican, but you've arrived at different points of view than the majority of people and the majority of legislators in your party have. And I'd like to go over a couple of those issues and see how you've arrived at your point of view. As I said, you're a Christian, you're a Republican, but you support stem cell research. On what grounds do you disagree with the Bush administration, for example?
You know, let me just say this. I don't want to leave the impression that I am substituting my own religious point of view for some other religious point of view. I mean, what I'm saying is that people in government have to be open, and they can't be consciously just putting forth a political agenda, whether it's a conservative political agenda, a liberal political agenda, or somewhere in between. I think you have to try to call them as you see them. On the issue of stem cell research, people who are engaged in stem cell research will tell you that this is a very promising area, that science offers the possibility of unlocking very, very difficult scientific problems, matters relating to terrible diseases like Alzheimer's and Lou Gehrig's disease, and maybe even cancer. And I think that science should be able to do that, that it's very difficult to say, okay, let's shut the door on science. And I think the only explanation for either prohibiting stem cell research or trying to curtail it is a religious explanation. That is, it's a particular view that somehow life exists even before there's implantation of an egg in a uterus, that life exists in a petri dish. And I think most people would say that is not something that's consistent with their view of what's reasonable. And they would say maybe when there's implantation in the uterus, but not outside the uterus, not for cells that are never going to become living, walking, breathing human beings, never. They're never going to advance beyond the petri dish. And so it's my view that science should be allowed to get on with the important work of trying to find cures for these terrible diseases.
So you think that banning stem cell research, that the only explanation for that would be a religious one?
Yes, I think that's right.
But what does your religion tell you about stem cell research? What is your interpretation of your religion tell you about it?
You know, I, again, let me say that I don't think that government or people in government should make decisions solely on the basis of trying to implement their religious view, whether it's my religious view or somebody else's religious view. I don't mm-hmm. believe that. My own religious point of view, and I think the reason why some very devout religious people would say let's get on with stem cell research is that they see the human misery involved in these terrible diseases. And if there is a choice between cells that exist in a petri dish that will never become human beings and never will become implanted in a uterus on one hand, And my next-door neighbor, who has Alzheimer's disease, on the other hand, I choose my neighbor. And so, I mean, my religious view is that the love commandment would say to many people who are very devout people, devout Christians, this research is important to alleviate human misery.
Now, what about Terry Schiavo? What was your position? Because this is something you criticized your party for. What was your position on how to handle her case?
Well, the Terry Schiavo case was one that was the immediate cause of the first op-ed piece that I wrote for the New York Times, because I thought that it was an outrageous situation, and it struck me as a dramatic departure from what I had thought to be traditional Republican principles. Suddenly, you had Washington in the act. You had members of Congress scurrying around, rushing to pass legislation, trying to stop the removal of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube, trying to keep her hooked up to this artificial tube. You had the President of the United States flying back from Texas. You had the odd instance of empowering the federal court to get into something that had been within the province of the state courts. Now, the notion that Washington has the answer, that Washington should come to the rescue, that the state court should cede responsibility to the federal court or be bumped by Congress the name of putting the federal courts in place, these are really inconsistent with anything I ever associated with the Republican Party or basically basic Republican concepts. So I thought that it was wrong. Also, I thought that it was a sad state of affairs when this poor soul, who was in a persistent vegetative state, was kept hooked up to a feeding tube. I thought that matters should be allowed to run their own course, that she had, at least the Florida court so held, stated her position to her husband that she didn't want to be kept alive under these circumstances, and therefore I thought that she should be allowed a merciful death.
One more position I want to ask you about and how it compares to your party, which is a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage.
Right. Well, my personal view is that marriage is between a man and a woman. But I can't imagine the issue of homosexuality finding its way into the Constitution of the United States. I mean, to me, that really is a stretch. Here is a Constitution that deals with the whole setup of government. It deals with matters such as freedom of the press and freedom of speech and due process of law and on. And then suddenly people are proposing that in addition to those important subjects, the issue of gay marriage gets into our Constitution. I just don't see it. I mean, I think that that is really a stretch. And I think that this is pretty much of a political movement aimed at appeasing a religious point of view in the name of saving the institution of marriage. Now, I think the institution of marriage certainly is under fire. The divorce rate is very, very high. But I don't see any relationship between homosexuality and the institution of marriage. So the idea that this proposed constitutional amendment somehow protects marriage seems to me to be a stretch.
You're retired from that as well now, aren't you?
No, I've not been defrocked yet.
Oh, okay. I'm still, you're retired from that work.
I'm still ordained. I'm not, you know, right now I'm the guy in the pew. I'm enjoying, you know, just showing up and being in the pew, but they haven't given me the boot. Some people would probably say that they should, but not yet.
Do you think that your views and your concerns about your party are actually shared by many Republicans who just don't feel comfortable speaking out about it now?
Yes, and I would also say that what I've said about Christianity is shared by a lot of Christians and non-Christians, too. I mean, the response to these two op-eds has been remarkable. I hoped that it would be strong because, you know, I didn't want to just be a one-man parade. If it was just, you know, good old Jack Danforth saying, here's how I feel about issues, well, okay, so write a piece and then so what? But my real hope is that people would think about these things and speak out on them and weigh in, especially with people in politics and with their congregations that they belong to.
Now, you say that you think that there are, a fair number of Republican legislators who agree with your criticisms of how the Republican Party has become the party of Christian conservatives. Why do you think they're not speaking out?
I don't know. I think, you know, I think one thing that's too bad is that people who are in politics aren't speaking out. Now, maybe it's just self-preservation. You know, I mean, it's, in other words, the marriage of Republican, say, economic and foreign policy with the religious right is something that works. And so, you know, why go against something that works? But my hope is that there'll be sufficient numbers of Republicans who will begin pushing back on this and saying, wait a second, this is not the Republican Party we know, that there will be an incentive for at least some Republicans in public office to speak out. I've also been concerned that our churches, what I would call, you know, the more moderate or mainline churches, have also been silent, pretty much silent, on what religion means. So it's been the conservative Christians who have been most outspoken about how they define the nature of Christianity. So my hope is that churches such as my own, the Episcopal Church, will be more forthright in trying to express the fact that there are different views of the relationship between politics and religion.
I want to quote you something that was published in the New York Times this week. It was an article by the reporter Richard Stevenson on Monday, June 27th. And he wrote, "President Bush still so dominates politics in Washington that there is little open criticism of him, and few Republicans are willing to challenge the strategy of Mr. Rove and other top aides. But behind the scenes, there's increasing grumbling from Republicans about the White House political style." And then he quotes an anonymous senior House Republican as having said, "There's a view among House members and the leadership staff that the White House feels it has to deal with us to move legislation, but that otherwise we don't exist to them." I'm wondering if you're hearing the kind of grumbling that this article described?
Well, I'm in St. Louis, not Washington, but let me just say this. I am a supporter of President Bush. I have supported him in both of his campaigns, actively supported him in both of his campaigns. I generally agree with his positions. I served in his administration not for very long, but for 6 months, and was proud to do that. I think he is a good president, and I'm happy to be his supporter and proud to be his supporter. So I don't want to give the impression that somehow I am a Republican who has turned on President Bush. That absolutely is not the case. But I think this marriage of religion and politics is not just attributable to one person or an advisor to one office holder. I think it's much deeper than that. There are members of Congress who say, and there have been articles written about them point blank, that they view it as their job to advance the kingdom of God through legislation.
Nevertheless, when you say that you think there's Republicans in Congress who agree with you but who are afraid or uncomfortable about speaking out, do you think that they're worried about pressure from the White House if they
no,
do speak
I don't,
out?
No, I don't think that's true. I think that what happens is, you know, I mean, most people who run for, let's say, the Senate are not elected by huge margins. Let's say it could be, say, 52 to 48, something like that. And so they are very concerned about their political base. And if their political base consists of very energetic people who are voting for them and supporting them because they think that this is God's will or that this is God's way, then the people who are trying to win the next election want to satisfy them and want to make them happy.
You were one of Clarence Thomas's chief supporters, and in fact, I think your law firm was the first to actually hire him.
Brian Cabe did not hire Clarence, but I hired him. When I was state attorney general, I hired him right out of law school, and he came to work in the attorney general's office in Jefferson City, and then when I left the attorney general's office to go to Washington, he then went to work for Monsanto in their legal department, and then I hired him again from Monsanto to come to work for me in the Senate.
Since you were his mentor and his chief supporter during the Supreme Court nomination, I'm wondering what you think of his positions on the Establishment Clause on separation of church and state.
My relationship with Clarence Thomas is that I'm his friend and he's my friend. And he is just one of God's good people. He is just a wonderfully warm, decent human being. And I have not set myself up as the critic of his jurisprudence. I haven't done that kind of an analysis, and it's not the nature of my relationship with him. I am sure that I would agree with some things that he has written and disagree with others. That was always the case of my relationship with Clarence, even when he served with me both in Jefferson City and in Washington. But he is much more than any position that he takes, either on the court or that he took before he went on the court. He is just one of the good people, and that was why it was so painful to see what he went through in the confirmation process.
Would you like to see Clarence Thomas become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court?
No.
Why?
Because he would have to go through confirmation all over again in the Senate. The Chief Justice has to be confirmed as well as members of the court. And just selfishly, I don't want to go through this again. I don't want to see that again. I don't want this meanness to happen to him again. He's too kind a person.
While we're on the subject of confirmations, you were the former ambassador to the United Nations, and President Bush wants to appoint John Bolton to serve as ambassador. The Democrats have blocked that. The president might decide to make him a recess appointment. And I'm wondering if you think that he is the right choice. And I'll just mention one of the now famous quotes that he made that his critics have been mentioning a lot. He once said, if the UN building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. So some people think that if he's appointed to the UN, it would be, you know, like putting somebody who really doesn't like the organization to be our representative to it.
Mm-hmm. I can't say that I know John Bolton. I met him once. I spent maybe 15 minutes with him. And I don't have any opinion about his personality or his style. I do think that since I left the Senate, something has changed with respect to confirmations. It used to be that there was a presumption in favor of presidential nominees. I don't think that exists anymore. And I think that it would have been unthinkable when I was in the Senate to try to block a presidential nominee by filibuster for a position like representative to the United Nations. It would have been viewed as a presidential prerogative, and especially in a position like that, which is not a policymaking position, let the president have his person, and there would have been a vote. Maybe there would have been some people voting against the nominee. But here you have the blockage of a presidential nominee by filibuster for a non-policy-making position. And that's just a difference of how things are done now and a difference that's happened in the United States Senate. I think that from the standpoint of the U.S. mission to the United Nations, it would be a good thing if they would have a permanent representative in place. There are five people at full strength who are of ambassador's rank at the U.S. mission to the U.N. Now they're down to two. And so it's a mission that doesn't have its full complement of leadership, and it would be better off if they would have the full complement of leadership.
You served as U.N. ambassador in the Bush administration for actually a very brief period, less than a year. It was just a few months.
Mm-hmm. 6 months.
Yeah. Why did you resign after such a short amount of time?
Because the United Nations was not located in St. Louis. It's just as simple as that. This is the third time I've left the East Coast to come back home to St. Louis. I was born here. I married the girl across the street. Three of our children live in St. Louis. Seven of our grandchildren live in St. Louis. I'm at the same law firm, Brian Cave, the same law firm that I was in when I was in my 20s. This is the third time I've gone back to Brian Cave, so I'm glad they'll have me back. But I really like my life right now. I'm having a lot of fun, and it's as the lifestyle goes, it's just what I want to be doing right now.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Glad to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
John Danforth is former senator from Missouri and former UN ambassador.